if you watch the slide set go around and around and around, it actually said that I'd be teaching from February 28th up through May 31st. And so, actually, I came up here yesterday and taught. No. A lot of you have asked about my wife. Her and Alyssa are up in Dallas. Our daughter plays volleyball, and they had a significant tournament up there yesterday, and they were supposed to be in late last night, but Angie called about 5. You know, if you have a good day in volleyball, it's kind of round-robin play, and you play till you're eliminated. And so you can always tell when she calls you at 5 o'clock and said, we still have 2 more, you know, sets to go, that they're having a pretty good day. And I asked her where she was at, and she said, I'm out in the car. And I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm trying to sleep. I'm so exhausted. So she called me about 8:30, and she said, we're headed home. And I said, no, I'm going to call and get you a hotel, and you guys just stay put there. I was afraid that they may not see it all the way in. So they're probably on their way home this morning. I appreciate for those who have asked. As I've said before, I kind of like yard work a lot. And yesterday morning I got up since they were gone, and I mowed my lawn. I put iron on my lawn with fertilizer all year long, and so I have an evergreen lawn. It never turns brown. And it's really stupid because that means I have to mow it 12 months of the year. But I like yard work okay, so that's okay. And when I get up yesterday morning to mow the lawn, I mow it real low, you know, through the wintertime here. And then as we get into springtime, I kind of raise the mower up. But so I mowed it really low yesterday, and, you know, all the leaves were gone. And you've not seen a better looking yard than what I did yesterday. And so I came back in, and I ran upstairs to shower because since Angie's gone, I thought I'd go grocery shopping for her and get some pressure off of her as well. Well, and get some favor out of that as well. Oh, and when I shop, I also get to buy anything I want to buy. So there were a lot of reasons in that. And so while I was upstairs showering, the Lord sent some wind in here. You might have noticed yesterday, and I have a couple of live oak trees, and they don't lose their leaves. As you know, they don't lose leaves in the fall. They leave, and they don't lose hardly any of their leaves. But whatever they're going to lose, they lose, you know, right as you go into springtime. And that little wind the Lord sent down yesterday, I came back out and looked like it snowed in my yard, and I was devastated, you know. So I went and shopped. I did a number of errands. And I went and shopped. I got home about 3:30 yesterday afternoon, and the Lord in His wisdom, you know, knew what He was doing, because all the other neighbors' yards are not mowed, so their grass is kind of up a little bit, you know, and when leaves hit their lawn, they stick. You know what I mean? They stick in the blades of grass. But because I'd mowed mine so low, the leaves couldn't stick, and the wind got so ferocious that when I came back, all the leaves were out of my yard, and they were my neighbors' yards. And it was just a grand day at the end of the day, you know? It was just a good day. I mean, I don't have any friends on my street, but it was a good day at my house. It's just a good day. We're going to be studying now the book of Joshua. You need to turn to Joshua chapter 1, but I want to lay some track before we actually get started studying the book. By the way, I really do love yard work. At 55 years old, I still lay out in that old green grass and look up at the blue skies. Is it not true that on some days in Texas, we have just the bluest skies that could ever be anywhere in the world? And at 55 years old, I've finally convinced Angie to come out there and lay in the grass with me a few days when I'm out there mowing, because she'll bring me water. I hope I never get too old to lay in the grass. I've had neighbors come over and ask me if I were okay on occasion because they thought I passed out. But, you know, I just love to look at the sky sometimes. I mean, the blue in Texas is just blue. Just nothing like it. Before we get to Joshua chapter 1, I want to lay a little bit of track with you here. And for some of you, it'll be rehearsal, and for some of you, maybe it's just building that study blocks that you need to get through Scripture. And I approach Scripture by building study blocks for myself. In other words, while daily Bible reading is a good thing, it's a great thing, I really do, out of necessity for myself, need to take a book or periods of history and put the books or the chapters kind of in some kind of order for me and get the characters all aligned, so I can kind of get the thread of the story or the theme of the story through the Bible. And so that's really what I want to do this morning, very, very quickly, before we get to Joshua chapter 1. We're going to read Joshua chapter 1. We're going to make some pretty practical applications out of Joshua chapter 1 before we're done. But the story of Joshua chapter 1 really starts in Genesis chapter 12. And by the time you get to Genesis 12, if you think about just kind of building blocks to work from, by the time you get to Genesis chapter 12, you've already got the creation, the flood, and the Tower of Babel. And if you just remember those three things, you've just about got the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis. But in Genesis chapter 12, we introduce this fellow named Abram, who eventually becomes Abraham. And Abraham receives a promise in that chapter, and he's told by God to leave his country and go to a land. And by the way, that was the entire extent of definition of what he was asked to do. And I want to make a point there, that sometimes God has asked us to do things when we can't see the end result and we may not understand the purpose. But children of faith do what God asked them to do. And Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 8 tells us that when God asked Abraham to leave, that he, Abraham, did not know where he was going. He didn't have a clue. The only information he had is that God said leave and he went. That covenant or that promise in 12 is ratified in Genesis chapter 15. As a matter of fact, you know about all you need to know about Abraham if you'll study Genesis chapter 12 up to Genesis chapter 25. Now, we have a lot of anecdotal information in the New Testament about his faith and so on and so forth. That's really the story of his life as it relates to Scripture. And that promise that's in Genesis chapter 12 is ratified or made into a covenant in Genesis chapter 15. Now, I don't know if Debbie Pirates is here, but I think he worked for a title company. I know when I closed my home, I showed up at a title company. And while I was in that, and my real estate agent went down there, the only reason she was there was to get her commission. I mean, I don't think she really cared for any other reason. But I sat there and we signed documents for 30 minutes. I guarantee you we did. And what it was a ratification of the deal that we had struck. And that's exactly what happens in Genesis chapter 15. The deal is ratified. And the deal that's being struck is the promise that God has made is that He'll build a nation out of Abraham. And out of that nation, He will give to them a land. And in that ratification of Genesis chapter 15, I'm telling you, brethren, the real estate deal took place and it was legally binding. Now, they hadn't received the land, and there was no actualization of that promise yet, but in God's mind it was a done deal and it was ratified, become legal, Genesis chapter 15. And yet Abraham didn't have a people, he didn't have a nation, and he wasn't sure of even the land he was going to. Well, of course, you know the story about Sarah and how she was filled with disbelief about having children, but sure enough, here comes a child named Isaac. And when Isaac arrives over time, and after God has Abraham's faith tested, and as Isaac grows into a young man, the very promise that God had made to Abraham, he reiterates again to Isaac. And he said, not only did I swear this to your father and ratified it with him, but I ratify it with you. Out of Isaac comes two children, Jacob and Esau. And out of those two children, Jacob ends up being the one who receives the birthright blessing and ultimately receives the promise that Abraham had received. Once again, reiterated now to Jacob, that in thy seed there will be a nation and there will be a land. And then Jacob, through a couple of wives and through maidservants, ends up having 12 sons. And those 12 sons' names ultimately become the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. Of those 12 children, there's one who's youngest, whose name is Joseph. And I know what it is to be the younger. I was raised as the younger. And as you know, they had a little bit of family conflict, and so the other 11 brothers conspired extensively to get rid of Joseph, for he finally ends up in bondage. I understand that. My brother spent all of his life trying to kill me. And no matter what I said to my parents, because he was the favorite child, they didn't have any confidence in me. And Ken, I understand this concept of being disciplined. My parents beat the fire out of me, and it was mostly his fault. So I understand being the least. I really do. Joseph sold off into Egyptian bondage, lives in Potiphar's house as a servant. Potiphar's wife's just as evil as day is long and tries to seduce him, and he won't have anything to do with it. He stays righteous. But as a result of a false accusation, you know that Joseph is thrown into prison. And in prison, he meets a couple of guys. One's a baker, one's a cupbearer. They have some dreams, and he does a good job of interpreting those dreams. And then at a later date, Pharaoh has some dreams, and the cupbearer says, "You know, I know who can interpret that dream for you. I was in prison one time. It just came to my mind. This guy named Joseph took care of my dreams. He can take care of yours." And as a result of Joseph being able to interpret those dreams, late in the book of Genesis, he's elevated to the second spot in Egypt. Now has enormous control, enormous authority. Now, brethren, we just jump from Genesis chapter 12, Genesis chapter 50, just in those three or four or five Bible characters. All that story takes place just in those few chapters. In Exodus chapter 1, though, we're told that now there's a new Pharaoh in town. There's a new sheriff in town. And this new sheriff, he doesn't like the Israelites. He looked out over the Israelites there who had been so prosperous. Well, you recall that Joseph and his brothers were reunited, and all the family moved to Egypt, and they prospered there. He gave them the best of the land. And now this new sheriff in town who shows up, he doesn't like the Israelites, and he looks out, and he sees how prosperous and how populated they are, and he's concerned that there might be a rebellion and that his nation could be overthrown or suffer greatly. And so he has them put in servitude. And for 400 years, they become brickmakers using mud, clay, straw, and water. They're servants for 400 years. Servants without honor, without privilege, and without home, without land. They're just a people who are nothing more than servants. But also in the book of Exodus, we know that there's one who's called Moses who shows up on the scene at God's bequest. And he has 10 intimate discussions with Pharaoh before he convinces Pharaoh of his arguments that God's people need to be let go so they can get on to actualizing the promise that was legally given back in Genesis chapter 12. Now, the 400 years of slavery, I'm not sure that those people knew that they still had business they needed to take care of. But Moses knew they had business that they needed to take care of. And after 10 intimate discussions, that happens, and they're allowed to leave Egypt, and they're allowed to leave Egypt with great wealth. And now they're headed to that very promised land to actualize that very promise that was given in Genesis chapter 12. You know, the march from Egypt to the promised land is about 13, 14-day journey at most. But they're not going to make that journey in 13 or 14 days to the promised land. It's going to take them 40 years to walk that little 14-day journey. And it's going to take them 40 years because at one point in time, as they get close to the promised land, as you recall in the book of Numbers, about 13, before we get to Numbers 13, if you recall, as they get close to the promised land, they're marching from Egypt. Now they're close to the promised land. They have all the wealth of Egypt with them, all the livestock of Egypt with them. And boy, if they can get to promised land, they can become a great nation, right? And as they get close there, they stop. And Moses says, "Let's take account of all the men who are 20 years old and older." Numbers chapter 1. And when they finish that census, the number is 605,550. A little bit over 600,000 men who are older than 20 years old. And they're sitting at the very border of the promised land. Now, interesting enough, they say, "You know, we ought to send in about 12 spies to see what the land looks like because we know we're going to have a fight on our hand." They do that, and out of the 12 spies that come in, 10 come back and say, "What in the world are we thinking? We're better off in Egypt than we are here." But two, Joshua and Caleb, Joshua the fellow who's our hero in this book, say, "Well, we're more than able to take the land." And God is so upset because of their lack of faith. Remember in Genesis chapter 12, Abraham of faith, where God said, "Leave the country and go to the land." He didn't know where he was going. He said, "But I'm on my way." And here are people who sit at the border of the promised land who say, "But we can't take it." And God is so angry. He says, "I'm going to destroy them all." And at the pleadings of Moses, and Moses alone, God says, "Look, I won't destroy them today. But I guarantee you there's going to be 40 years of wilderness wandering. And every man who is 20 years old and above from that census of 605,550, there's going to be 605,548 graves who will not enter promised land." There are going to be some grave digging going on for the next 40 years because those were not going in to promised land. That'll be my punishment. And so for 40 years, Israel has been wandering around, wandering, wandering, wandering. By the way, all that time that they wandered, they did nothing but grumble and gripe and complain. That's just about the way God's children behave sometimes, right? We mess it up, and then we blame everybody else, and all we want to do is complain about it rather than repent of it. That grumbling got so bad in Numbers chapter 20, complaining they don't have water. So Moses works out a deal with God where he's going to talk to a rock, and now that rock will gush forth water. Now, there was another event early on where the same situation happened, and God let him strike the rock, and the rock produced water. But this time, God said, you just speak to the rock. Moses didn't obey. Moses struck the rock rather than speaking to it. And I'm not sure of all the things that happened there. I'm not sure that's the single thing that caused the problem. It might be. I don't know. But regardless, at the end of the day, God said, because you didn't trust me, not even you, Moses, will enter the promised land on this earth. Not even you. You'll never see promised land. I'm sure that broke Moses' heart. After all the work he had done, all the complaining he had put up with, all the disobedience he had seen, coming down off the mountain, breaking the stones with the golden calf. Don't you know? When God said, not even you, it pierced his heart. Well, now we come to Joshua chapter 1. And the 40 years are over. And now there's a people who's ready to go to promised land. And that's really what the story of Joshua is about. It's the story of conquest. And so when you think about building blocks to do your Bible study, if somebody says, well, where would I go read about the conquest of Canaan? Why, you ought to automatically click and say, I know that's in Joshua. I may not know the chapters and the verses, but I know it's the book. It's the book of conquest. And Joshua can be broken up really in three parts. And the first part of the book is nothing more than just conquest. About the first 12 chapters, and we're going to spend a lot of time in those 12 chapters, is really nothing about but taking of the land. Then there's a section in the book of Joshua that's related to the division of the land after it's conquered. And we'll not spend a lot of time there. And then toward the very end of the book, there's a section in there where we have the farewell addresses of Joshua that are more than worth reading and studying. And so we'll spend some time there before we finish this course as well. But what we want to do is start this morning in Joshua chapter 1, where now the people have the 400 years of bondage behind them, and they have the 40 years of wandering behind them, and now good things are going to happen. And the very promise that was legally made in Genesis chapter 12 and Genesis chapter 15 can now be honored in the book of Joshua, where these people actually begin to get their promised land. You understand that for 400 years, or certainly from the day they left Egypt forward, but I believe even from the time of creation, even the time of Genesis chapter 12 in my own mind, that God was preparing a special people to give them a special law to take them to a special land for a very special occasion of the coming of a very special person. You understand that? And that is the story, isn't it? That's the story of the Bible from cover to cover. Special people, special law, going to a special place for a special purpose to bring a special person named Jesus Christ. I mean, if you got that in the Old Testament, you've got the Old Testament. And so let's take a look at Joshua chapter 1. I want to invite you to read that with me. It's not going to be up on the screen. If you didn't bring your Bible, I'm sorry for that. Brethren are supposed to share, and so if there's a sister and a brother who have a Bible, and you know they could share and loan you a Bible, that'd be a good thing. But not all of our brethren are that gracious, but some of them are, and so you might be sitting on one who do that. I don't know. I'll let you work that out. But you know, I brought my Bible, so I'm going to read out of my Bible. Joshua chapter 1. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' aide, Moses, my servant, is dead now. Then you and all these people get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land that I'm about to give to them, to the Israelites. I will give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. Your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon, from the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country to the great sea on the west. No one, absolutely no one, will be able to stand up against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you. Joshua, I will never, ever forsake you. So you be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to the forefathers to give them. Genesis chapter 12, Genesis chapter 15. I am now going to give to you the very thing that I swore, coveted, the legal transaction, the real estate transaction that took place in Genesis chapter 12 and 15. Verse 7, be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave to you. Do not turn to it. Don't turn to the right or the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you to be strong and courageous? Listen, did I not command you to be strong and courageous? I thought I commanded you to be strong and courageous. Don't be terrified. Don't be discouraged. For the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. So Joshua ordered the officers of the people. He said, look, you go through the camp and you tell the people, get your supplies ready. 3 days from now, we're crossing the Jordan. We're going to go. We're going to go take possession of the land. Lord God's going to give it to us as our very, very own. But to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, Joshua said, now, you two and a half tribes, you remember the command that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you. The Lord your God has given you rest and has granted you this land, your wives and your children and your livestock must stay in the land that Moses gave you east of the Jordan. That side of the Jordan. Back in Numbers, they struck a deal with Moses and they said, we're not sure. Man, this land right here is so good. It's so good for our livestock. We're herdsmen people. Can we not just have it? Moses struck a deal with them and said, Yeah, I guess that'll be okay. Yeah, that's good. You can stay on the east side of the Jordan. But now back up to our text, verse 14, latter half. But all your fighting men, fully armed, must cross over ahead of your brothers. You're to help your brothers until the Lord gives them rest as He has done for you, and until they too have taken possession of the land the Lord your God is giving them. After that, you may go back and occupy your own land, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you east of the Jordan toward the sunrise. Then they answered Joshua, well, whatever you've commanded us, you know we're going to do it. And wherever you send us, we will go. Why, just as we have fully obeyed Moses, so we'll obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as He was with Moses. Whoever rebels against your word and does not obey your words, whatever you may command them will be put to death. Only we want you to be strong and courageous, Joshua. So they're getting ready to go. So, for 40 years, they've been wandering. And now, they're ready to go. So, what would you and I, as wanderers in this world, be able to learn from a people who are now ready to cross over into Promised Land? Well, let's see if there's a couple of things in here that we might be able to get out of the text that might help us. The first thing that comes to my mind is in the first couple of verses there, where it's noted to us that Moses, God's servant, is now dead. And now, because he's out of the way, it appears like that he was almost an encumbrance. Until Moses was dead, they couldn't go into Jordan, or in the Promised Land, cross Jordan into the Promised Land. And so, we understand a couple of things, I think, about Moses and the situation that Moses proposes. The first situation is, brethren, is that no man, no family, and likely no congregation is in every one of those are indispensable to God's plan. For individuals who will not work with God, but who oppose God, who disobey God, who do not hold on to the truth of God, they become dispensable individuals, don't they? See, God's plan was not going to be thwarted no matter what Moses did or what anyone else did. God's plan was going to be realized. But the second thing that I think it teaches me is that the decisions of individuals, or individual decisions, can have ramifications on generations to come. I want you to ponder that for just a moment. That your individual decisions can have ramifications for generations to come. You know, I worry about that. I worry about that a lot. I've been in the church long enough and have seen a lot of families who have grown up in the church, and if you were to go find one of their children who's faithful, you'd have to look around the world for them. Because you see, the parents never made church that important, never made God that important, never made Scripture that important, never made obedience that important. The family made other decisions. The parents made other decisions. I appreciated the context of your lesson this morning. I've appreciated all the context of your lessons that says there is a thing called leadership and responsibility and exampleship. There is something around that. And that we are capable. I worry for my four children. Have I done a good enough job of impressing on them the importance of God in my life? That it'll be important in their life? Have I made the right decisions when it came to around career decisions versus my family life to exhibit that God and God's family is more important than some of the other things I may have chosen in my life? So I think we learn that an individual's decisions can have consequences on generations to come. And that should probably make us all nervous. If it doesn't make us nervous, it certainly ought to drive us to our knees to ask God for help. So first thing is, God's plan won't be, no matter who you are or who you think you are, if you're not going to obey, God will find a way in spite of you. And secondarily, the decisions that we make have long-term consequences on a whole bunch of other people, or can have long-term consequences on a whole bunch of other people than ourselves. And I must tell you, I'm not sure that we've become so calloused, and I hope that we haven't. But you know, to some degree, I mean, we've talked about the age of accountability and this concept of individual accountability about our souls to the point that we almost say, well, you know, our kids will grow up and they'll have to figure it out. But I'm not sure exactly. That's exactly what God had in His mind as He put mothers and fathers into the family and their roles and responsibilities around being sure that God's important, the church is important, things are important, right? You know, last time I taught, it's been a while, we were had been asked to move to Guadalajara, and some of you still ask if that decision's on or off, and that decision's been off for a long time. But about 5 months ago, they did ask me to come. They came to me and asked me to take over America's credit division for Hewlett-Packard. And 5 months ago, that looked like a great decision when the economy was a little bit better. 5 months later, it's hard work. I'm seeing 12, 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning about 3 days a week. We're averaging 15 bankruptcies a day out of a portfolio of 6,000 customers. Those customers are people like General Motors. We carry over $450 million in AR. These are large customers with large balances that require a lot of work. And sometimes I wonder if my individual decisions around my career may not be impeding my ability to be a good father, a good mother, you know, good parent to my children, a good brother to you, faithful in my walk. So, brethren, our individual decisions can have some very significant consequences. And, you know, and I'm being very candid with you. I'm going to work my way out of that situation soon, or I'm not going to continue in that situation, period. Now, it's taken me a while to get there. But I'm going to tell you the truth. There's no career. There's no decision worth you making that'll interfere with your walk. Not one. I don't care how prestigious, how visible, or how impacting it is. There's just not one. But beyond Moses, in Joshua chapter 1, we see something else that happens. After we get past Moses, and now God is talking to Joshua in what we just read, God tells Joshua that there has to be a human response about what's fixing to happen. They're fixing to cross Jordan into Promised Land. And God, in a number of phrases here, is now going to tell Joshua, let me tell you about the human response. Let me tell you how this works. And the deal is, here's the deal. The deal is that you're going to get blessed and you're never ever going to lose and you're going to always have victory if you'll exercise the human response. And different than a lot of churches that exist today, that doesn't mean that if you'll give me a tithe or if you'll send me money, you'll get blessing. Now, your stewardship is something you do need to take care of, but that's not where he centers his arguments at. He has a different discussion with Joshua. And you know what he starts with? He starts with the concept that before you can possess, you have to dispossess. Have you ever thought about that? If you were to read back in Deuteronomy, it actually says in Deuteronomy that they are to expel every inhabitant of the land, either expel or murder, kill every inhabitant of the land. They're to purify the land. They need to dispossess in order to possess. Now that's kind of an interesting deal, isn't it? That you got to move stuff out to put other stuff in. Kind of interesting, isn't it? And we don't necessarily think that way. I mean, not all of us. Some of us may. I mean, I don't always think that. Somehow or another, sometimes I kind of think on some days I can have my feet on both sides of the fence. That I can hold on to some of this stuff, and then I can kind of hold on to my spiritual aspects as well, right? But I think sometimes we've created an artificial standard around how we perceive people who are spiritual. You know what I mean? I mean, we think the elders are spiritual if we don't hear any bad thing about them. You know? We believe the preacher's probably a spiritual guy as long as he preaches a pretty decent lesson and he's not scandalous. Kind of interesting, isn't it? But I think the nature of true growth and the nature of true spirituality is the fact that every one of us has some faults and we need to be in the business of dispossessing some things out of our lives in order that we can possess other things in our lives. I really think that's the better spiritual context of spirituality, spiritual growth. I mean, that'd really be a better measurement barometer, I believe, around Christians. Say, you know, old Brother Joe's got this problem or Sister Susie's got this problem. But I tell you, they're working on it, they're moving that stuff out and other things are coming in. But brother, I'm going to tell you the truth. You cannot possess until you dispossess. Now, I know, Brett, you're going to find this shocking. You may or may not. You might find this shocking. You might find this shocking. And I'll come back to this in a minute. But Angie and I have had people in our home at 2:30 in the morning, husband and wife, in our living room, who've wanted to meet with us because they have adultery in their marriage. Christians. And the wife is threatening to leave, and the husband's saying, I just can't break it off with this individual. I can't dispossess in order to possess my family. I want to walk both sides of the line. I'm just going to tell you, they're not going to be successful in their acquisition of Cana, of the Promised Land, if they don't move the old out so they can get the new in. And brethren, you never ever, you're going to be marginally successful. You might be a little bit successful, but you're never going to be as successful until you decide to dispossess some things in order to possess some other things. I got some bushes. I've lived in my house for 13 years, and I went to Houston Garden Center, and they had some bushes on sale, and they were really green and pretty, and I bought them. I didn't even know what they were. It could have been marijuana, and I wouldn't have had a clue, you know. But I bought them, and it's one, you know, and I put them out in my yard, and they looked really good. But I'm going to tell you about those bushes. It's like some Christians. Those bushes have never been hedged. They have not grown not one inch. And in the wintertime, Houston Garden Center didn't tell me this, they lose their leaves and the ugliest bushes you've ever seen. And so yesterday I dug three of them up, and I'm feeling really good about that. But they've been ugly for 13 years. I mean, they've never not grown not one ounce. That sometimes reminds me of some brethren I know. And I'll tell you something else, sometimes it reminds me of me. Sometimes I'm not in the growth mode. And I'm just going to tell you that growth is painful because growth is going to require you, true growth, is going to require you to dispossess some things that you might still be holding on to. I mean, it's hard to be a Christian and still go to the restaurants, drink four or five glasses of wine, have a cigar, and be like the rest of the guys. Somewhere in there, you got to make a bona fide, absolute, actual decision to move from here to here. And God says that Canaan's success, the success of acquiring Cana, is going to be dependent upon them dispossessing in order to possess. Now, what'd they do? What was the reality? What'd they do? After they got in the land, what'd they do? I didn't hear you. Got tired of fighting. Compromised, and they started making alliances with the very heathens, didn't they? They wasn't the last people who ever did that, were they? They got in the land and they got political more than spiritual. They started creating alliances. And those alliances plagued them for the rest of their history. Didn't they? The rest of their history. So brethren, the human response in Joshua is the fact that there has to be a dispossession in order for there to be a possession. It also says that there has to be purity at the top. You look down at verse 5, on down the list there, and verse 9. Boy, as long as Moses was tracking to God, things were good. And as long as Joshua tracks to God, things are good. Ladies and gentlemen, as parents of your family, as heads of your house, there's real value to having purity at the top. Because purity at the top ensures success. It's not, I hope so, I hope we get it done. It ensures success. And so, man, as long as Joshua is faithful and true, they're going to have success. We've got to rush here. At least three times, in verse 6, 7, and 9, he's told to be strong and courageous. And strong means to be able or competent or to believe that you have the power. And courageous means that you're able to act out on your convictions. Be strong and courageous. Believe that you're empowered. Believe that you're enabled. And act out on that belief to go and do. It don't mean to just wake up and feel good. It means to say when you get up in the morning, because the God is with me, I will do it today. I will do those things I need to do. I'll overcome that habit I need to overcome. I'll be the example I need to be. In verse 7, the human response has to be obedience. And if there's anything that I love, as a matter of fact, it says that there is a path to walk, right? And it's so straight. And it's so recognizable that he says, don't turn to the right or to the left. I am amazed by our religiosity in America, for sure, as if truth can't be identified. And I'm amazed in some churches I've worked with that they believe that truth can't be identified. But whatever obedience is here, I'm telling you, he says, look, don't do anything on the left-hand side or on the right-hand side, just go and obey and do it. And I tell you, if you read the conquest of the first 12 chapters, you just go home and read this, you're going to find the reason that Joshua was successful is because of his childlike obedience. I mean, we're going to read about the fall of Jericho, right? How stupid were those instructions? How stupid was that? I got a doctor asking me to walk so I can save my life. If God asked me to walk around Jericho, I'd say, I'm not sure I want to do that. Because I'm telling my doctor, I'm not even sure I want to save my life. I mean, how stupid is that? And yet in his childlike obedience, the walls of Jericho are going to fall, aren't they? So the human response has to be obedience. And then another human response is meditation, right? It says to know my word and to keep it on your heart. I'm not reading the Bible with you folks. A lot of you guys are on the daily Bible reading program. And I'm not on that program, and it's not out of deference, but I am not on that program. And I signed up for that program. But as soon as I signed up, I thought the best thing to do was for me to dishonor my signature, and I did that, and I didn't tell anybody. But I'm not reading the Bible with you guys. I should be, but I'm not. I found another tool that I wanted to experiment with this year, and now looking back, I wish I was on your program. But this little tool I'm using has 8 steps in it. And it requires me to keep a journal every day. It takes about 15 minutes every day for me to keep a journal. I really wish I hadn't have done this. It's just about, you sign up here. And I'm thinking maybe in June or July I can rationalize dishonoring this commitment and not do it anymore. But it's onerous because I get up in the morning, the first thing I have to do by the steps that I've defined is I have to offer praise to God, not a prayer, praise. God, I praise you for the night rest. I praise you that my family is safe. I praise you that, you know, that the sun is shining this morning. And then you have to find a verse, and you know, you have to kind of say, is this a command or a promise or a prophecy? And then you have to say, what does this mean to me? You have to write this stuff down. You have to write it down. You just can't sit there and theorize about it. You have to write it down. One of the aspects of this deal, though, is that one of the steps requires you to actually spend some time in meditation on a spiritual matter. And after you meditate, then you kind of have to write down in a summary form in one or two sentences kind of what your thoughts were about it. Have you ever done that? Have you ever done, different than Bible reading, have you ever read something in the Bible and then sat back in your chair and spent some time meditating about that subject matter? That's hard to do. It gives me a headache. I mean, it really does. It gives me a headache. I'm sitting there saying, I wonder what I'm supposed to be thinking about this, and I'm not really enjoying what I'm doing anyhow. Oh, and another deal is, too, that every day you have to go find somebody and you have to say something nice to them or say something positive to them or tell them they're good people or something. I don't know if I have 365 people I feel that way about. I mean, it's going to be a long year. Matter of fact, I'm just almost to March and I'm out of people. So now I'm going to have to start with some of you brethren. But I mean, it's hard to stop and meditate, to have conscientious thoughts about a subject and put something together. But you know what he says? He says, meditate on my law. Keep my law in your heart. Do you know what one of the last things that Moses did? Now that the 40 years is older, if you read the book of Deuteronomy, if you're in the Bible reading deal, and you might already be past that, I don't know. But in Deuteronomy chapter 1, do you know what it says? In Deuteronomy chapter 1, and Deuteronomy means to state again, or to say again, right? The law restated. That's really what it means, right? It means to just, pardon my French, to puke it all out again. Just here's the law one more time. That's exactly what Deuteronomy means. And you know, if you read chapter 1 of Deuteronomy, about 3 or 4 verses down, you know what it says? It says as they're about to enter Canaan land, before they're allowed to go over, Joshua calls all the nation together. And he calls them, Moses calls the entire nation together. And he calls them together for one purpose and one purpose only. Do you know what it is? Do you know what that purpose is? He said, I want to walk you through the law one more time. Guys, we're fixing to embark on the biggest conquest you've ever seen in your life. You're going to get discouraged. It's going to be hard work. And before we go, I want to tell you one more time about the law. And so he spends the entire book of Deuteronomy telling them about the law, rehearsing the law before they go and fight these battles in the promised land. He rehearses the law. Says, I want you to meditate on the law because it's going to be tough work. Daily living and going to the jobs that you go to and fighting the battles that you fight with your children and helping your children, maturing your children, motivating your children and putting up with your friends and doing all things. That's hard work. And so if you meditate on the law, day and night, there's something in there somewhere that's going to help you. It's going to keep you straight. And so God says that's one of the human responses that need to take place here. Well, let me move on. In verse 9, it says that they are to stay away from individuals who discourage them and terrify them. I'll let these be my last comments, even though I have a couple of others. It says that they are not to be discouraged. They are not to be terrified. Angie and I will allow individuals who have problems into our home who seek our help, and we'll engage with them in order to help them. But years ago, Angie and I made a conscious decision about what we would and would not allow in our home. And we've, I think, held fairly true to that through the years. We have a neighbor in our neighborhood who, if they could get every neighbor in the neighborhood fighting with each other, why, they'd go to bed every night just as gratified as they'd be. We don't allow that in our home. We don't allow that kind of stuff in our home. We don't allow people who appear to be unwilling to help themselves and who just are totally negative and discouraging. We don't entertain that too well. That's hard for us. You know, another statement in the book of Deuteronomy, if you recall, is that as Moses started rehearsing the law, do you know what the Israelites said? They said, but wait a minute, Moses, you forgot why we are in the shape we're in. And you know what they said? They said, Moses, you've forgotten the fact that we sent spies over into the land, and 10 of those came back. And they were so discouraged, and they said so many negative things, and they pleaded their case so very well that they caused us to lose what? To lose heart. They so discouraged us, they caused us to lose heart. Brethren, we ought not be discouraging each other. We ought not be terrifying each other. I know some of you fighting a good fight with people out there that you think are wrong that are in the brotherhood, and that's fine. If you want to have those arguments, you go do that. I've seen very little evidence that those people have ever been turned as a result of all those battles, all that fighting. Why, I know two Christian brothers who were discouragers up in New York, and one of them got so discouraged that he was up on the edge of the bridge in New York about to jump. And the other old brother, who was also a discourager, saw him. He ran out there and grabbed his leg and said, wait a minute, don't jump. Get down from here and let's talk. The guy climbed down. And both those brethren talked, and all they talked about was negative things. Next thing I know, they both got up on the bridge and jumped. That's what discouragement will do, to cause you to quit. God says, don't be discouraged. Don't be terrified. And He says that because as long as I am with you, you don't have cause to feel that way. We're going to go take Canaan. We're going to go take Canaan because of me as your leader and you as my people. Well, you use complacent flat. I believe that if you looked at the end of the spirit chapter we just read, we would say they were just stupid. They were just stupid because I tell you what they said at the end of this chapter. We read it just a minute ago, and I'm finished with this comment, brethren. But if you recall, they said at the end of the chapter when Joshua was talking to the 2.5 tribes, and he says, you got to go over and help fight with your brothers. And they said, well, you know we will because we always did everything that Moses, what, commanded us. And that's exactly how we get. We get so arrogant that we think we're doing everything the Lord's commanded us and we think we got it right, right? And brethren, only stupid people make that comment. Brethren, let's never ever forget our heritage, where we came from. We came from darkness. Every one of us came from darkness. And it was as dark gets. And I'll tell you something else. Even though we're in Jesus, and Jesus has me saved and we're indeed, and I'm headed home, I'm going home. You can believe that if you make it to heaven, there's one person you're going to see there, and that's me. Because I'm going to heaven. And I'm going to take every bit of my family who wants to go with me. We're going to heaven. You can just write that down. And I expect to see you there. But we ought to never, ever forget our heritage. Ever. We came out of darkness. And we've got work to do and growth to be had, right? There's a human response to what God's doing for us. Brother, next week we'll start with the spies in Rahab. And we'll put some context around that. And then we'll march on through the book of Joshua. God bless you. Thanks.